Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Today our guest is Alex Gladstein, the Chief Strategy Officer at Human Rights Foundation and the VP of Strategy at Oslo Freedom Forum. We actually attended and spoke at Oslo Freedom Forum last year, and it was one of the best conferences we've been to. It was really well produced, amazing people, really important ideas, just really great overall. So I highly recommend it for anybody interested in human rights.
In this episode, we discuss why civil liberties make a country better for its people, the future of governance, internet and money, and anti-authoritarian technologies like Bitcoin. For all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/86.
A quick announcement before we start. Mike and I are working on designing some courses, and we'd like to get feedback from you guys on what you'd like to learn from us. So go to futurethinkers.org/courses and fill out our quick survey. It'll really help us out. Enjoy the episode. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining us today.
I am delighted to be here.
Cool. So why don't we start with just a really quick introduction for those who don't know of the Human Rights Foundation, how you guys got started and why?
Sure. Well, I think that the best way of looking at it is to consider that the world is broken down into different kinds of political systems and societies. And some of these societies and political systems are highly centralized and don't leave a lot of room for things like free expression, things like independent civil society, space for people to freely advocate and protest and ask for reforms. That's a hard-won political evolution, right? So there's only a certain subset of countries that have that kind of quality in society. Most people live under a government, live in a society where those things either are illegal or very rare, or very hard to do, right? So when you look at the numbers of the world, about 52% of humanity lives under some kind of authoritarian regime, okay? So this could be a military dictatorship, it could be a junta, it could be a king, it could be a group of religious extremists. There are many kinds of dictatorships, but I think we have to remember, even though a lot of people probably listening to this podcast live in a free society, or at least a relatively free society, that most humans don't. Right. So the Human Rights Foundation was founded to focus on those people and to consider they need kind of a special approach. There's special ways of dealing with someone. It's one thing if you live in France and you can go to your local Amnesty International, you can write an op-ed in a local newspaper, you can petition for reform. And indeed, in an election, you can kick out a corrupt politician. You know, this is not something you can do in Belarus, for example. Right. So the Human Rights Foundation focuses very specifically on closed and closing societies.
Mm-hmm. And when did you guys get started?
So our founder is a Venezuelan activist. His name's Thor Halvorsen. And he filed the paperwork for the Human Rights Foundation in 2005. And we started our operations in 2006. I joined in 2007. And our current chairman is Garry Kasparov, the chess icon.
We met him at the Oslo Freedom Forum last year. You were a bit nervous for that one, weren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Putin critic and chess icon at this point.
Yeah. He was a very intense and intelligent person.
Yeah. He's amazing.
So tell us a bit about the Oslo Freedom Forum before we kind of dive into the other subjects here. Mm.
Yeah. So I was about a year into my job at the Human Rights Foundation when Thor came up with the idea of the world needing a place at the same level as like the World Economic Forum or the Clinton Global Initiative or TED, a gathering point for leaders and influencers, but to focus on civil liberties and human rights. So for example, the World Economic Forum focuses on, of course, finance, stability, economic stability. CGI, while it was running, focused on humanitarian aid, development, mosquito nets, water, housing. And TED focuses on, you know, technology, ideas, kind of like the exciting edge of kind of tech and culture. And at each of these events, and there's more, but I'll use those three as examples. There are, of course, sometimes human rights stories, human rights content, human rights speakers, but they're definitely on the periphery And in fact, at some of these conferences, like certainly like in Davos, dictators get to talk as well. So, you know, you have the dictator of China or Rwanda or many different countries often taking the stage or even financing or underwriting some of these conferences. So the Oslo Freedom Forum was dreamt up as a gathering point for dissidents and troublemakers and peaceful revolutionaries and writers and poets and authors and free thinkers to get together to share their stories with an audience of influencers.
Yeah, for us, it was, I mean, our background with crypto has gone on for about 3 or 4 years now, maybe a little longer. For us going to all these conferences that we've gone to, it was very interesting at the beginning. There was kind of this anarchist / save the world / like, you know, take out the middlemen. It was very geeky. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of turned into this hyper-capitalist thing, and like all the conferences really changed over time. So we went to Oslo Freedom Forum last year, and it was such a breath of fresh air to all of the other ones that we had gone to. And it was so powerful, all of the stories that were being told at this event. We came away from it just kind of shell-shocked in a way from all of the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, look, these people who we gather tend to have a common dream or sort of a common dream. And the funny thing is their common dream resembles the countries that I bet a lot of people listening to this podcast or watching this live under today, where, you know, societies have problems. Free societies have lots of problems, whether it's incarceration or murder rates or, you know, weather or climate related problems, you know, economic and religious tensions. But generally speaking, you know, people living in dictatorships would trade everything, and they'd risk everything for just the tiniest percent of freedoms that a lot of people have in this planet. And that's what's kind of becomes quite clear during the event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are some of the, just to switch gears a little bit, what are some of the things that you guys are working on right now and some of the initiatives that you're focusing on right now with the foundation?
Sure. So we do a couple major things. We do public education. So we do a lot of writing. We do a lot of public events. We do a lot of work with the media to bring the stories of these incredible dissidents and activists in our network into, let's say, CNN or BBC or The Economist. So one of our goals is definitely to reach tens of millions of people with the stories of people who are trying to make their countries more free and open. We do direct advocacy. So we have initiatives which provide direct finances, technical support, tools, strategies, educational materials, technology to people living in closed societies. So an example of that is Flash Drives for Freedom. It's a program we run where we collect USB sticks that people don't really use anymore, or if people want to buy new ones, they can send them to us. And we have North Korean refugees and defectors that we work with who live in South Korea, who've escaped from North Korea, and they load up these drives with South Korean dramas and content from the outside world, and they smuggle them into North Korea where people don't have internet. So that's an example of one of our more like direct advocacy programs. And then we also do legal support. So we have a kind of a brain trust of 6 or 7 lawyers who specialize in different areas of the world. And, you know, we'll take cases of people who've been put in prison unfairly for their ideas. We'll try to apply pressure to different courts, governments, regional bodies. So I'd say kind of those are our three main areas. We also do have some fun student programs where we get young people involved. Obviously, as you saw at the Oslo Freedom Forum, there were quite a few young people. That's a very important thing for us too.
So you were talking before we started this episode that there's kind of a coalescing of all of the different areas of expertise that you have, what you guys have been focusing on with the various projects you're involved in. And now, you know, you talked about writing a book potentially on decentralized politics. So maybe we can start there.
Yeah. So what's been crystallizing to me in the last few years is that we have this general idea that decentralized politics, or let's call it liberal democracy, but basically people who live under rules, not rulers, is a good thing for humans. And the evidence is pretty massive. Whether you care about peace, you know, no two free countries, no two decentralized governments have ever fought each other. Whether you care about equality. You know, look at the Gini coefficients up and down all the different countries, whether you care about education, health rates, life expectancy, innovation, patent rates. Free countries are better for humans. And I think that's a pretty strong case to make. Now, it's being tested right now with the combination of, let's say, the Chinese government and things like AI. And Yuval Noah Harari and many others are pointing this out, that kind of the dominance of free societies is being tested. But for now, let's at least accept, or at least, you know, I will accept that I think free societies are better and that decentralized politics is better than tyranny. And what I've been noticing is that there's, at the same time, kind of an awakening, at least in Silicon Valley, where I'm based in that area and beyond, that having all of our data when it comes to technology in the hands of a tyranny, of one group of people, of one person, of a Zuckerberg or a Bezos or whatever, might be problematic too, right? And that seems to be a bipartisan thing, that at least in the United States, that most people think it's a bad idea to have all data when it comes to the technology realm in the hands of just a few. And then most recently, the last few years, I've gotten very into Bitcoin, and it's just been really eye-opening. And I think you could add kind of a third pillar, that maybe it's not a great idea for money to be controlled by just one party, or to be controlled in a dictatorship structure. Maybe power should also be distributed there. So that's kind of the three areas that I've been thinking about.
So they're governance, data, and money. Is that how you would classify them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can call it governance, data, money, governance, information, and money. I mean, I think the rise of democracy, the rise of the internet, and the rise of Bitcoin are kind of the three key kind of fact moments in each of those pillars, right? And each of them has like an increasingly small time frame, right? So Cleisthenes in ancient Greece is widely credited with the first guy, our first human to come up with the idea that we should be ruled by rules, not rulers. That was 2,600 years ago, right? The internet was you know, the ideas for the internet started to come together, 45 years ago. And then, you know, the ideas for Bitcoin were planted, you know, several decades ago, but really obviously were born just about 10 years ago with the launch of the Bitcoin software. So it's interesting to see the time frames on these three things also kind of collapse a little bit.
What do you think are some of the most interesting anti-authoritarian technologies right now that cover some of those areas?
Yeah, and I guess I'll try to flesh out what I mean by that. I think a lot of people have understood that AI and big data and machine learning are technologies that can be exploited or manipulated by or taken advantage of by governments and by corporations, right? So we talk about social engineering. We talk about the way that governments have always tried to do social engineering, right? Whether intentionally or not. But of course, you had the Soviet Union, Mao's China, the Khmer Rouge. Like, technology is bringing this to a new ease, I would say. If you look at what the Chinese government's doing in northwestern China right now, in Xinjiang, you know, they're using highly advanced technology to basically you know, take the Muslim population and cut them off, and sinicize is the verb they use, you know, basically make more Chinese Islam, and basically get rid of Islam and put these people in re-education camps. And they're doing this with the help of advanced technology. So there's a certain kind of technology that I would say is very authoritarian. And this is the kind of technology that when you, for example, read someone like Yuval Noah Harari or Jaron Lanier or someone like that, and they're worried about technology, it tends to be that kind of technology. At the same time, I think there's a whole area of technologies that are better for the individual, and I guess more difficult for a government or a corporation to have leverage on or to take advantage of. So these could include, obviously, generally speaking, the internet. I think you can make a good case is kind of a bottom up, kind of a grassroots technology. Bitcoin to me would be a key one. Censorship resistant money. You're starting to see new ones too, or at least relatively more new ones. I think censorship resistant storage is really interesting. So, you know, instead of putting up your website on Amazon Web Service or Azure or something, you could now put it up on something like IPFS, which is of course a distributed encrypted range of storage. where it would make it really difficult for a government or a corporation to take that information down. That's really interesting. And you're starting to get encryption, of course, I would argue is a key one. And, you know, we started with peer-to-peer messaging, right, with PGP or more recently Signal, all these different apps like Wickr, Wire, very, very important for individuals living under repressive governments. And you're starting to see advances in encryption where it's just beyond sending messages, but also where people are starting to understand and realize that we're going to be able to encrypt data in this like broader data in the same way. So for example, there's like this whole area of zero knowledge cryptography that Zcash, for example, the cryptocurrency is an implementation of. But the idea of like being able to basically prove to you that I have something without showing it to you is a simple way of putting it. But this could be done for people, you know, if you have your phone, you could have your location data on your phone. And if you use a certain kind of encryption, you could sell it to Google or to any other company while only disclosing certain things about it. So that's a really important area of this that I think is really exciting. And it's going to be pretty much that in conjunction with these other technologies is going to be what prevents free societies from turning into, you know, basically artificially, you know, AI juiced up dictatorships. Like, you know, we're going to have the WeChatization of our societies if we can't create really compelling, scalable alternatives that protect user rights and privacy. I think the writing's on the wall for that. It's one way or the other. So I think there should be more of an effort to understand and educate oneself about and learn about these kind of anti-authoritarian technologies.
Yeah, it's definitely a slippery slope with those things, because in the West, even though, you know, democracy is fairly transparent comparing to the rest of the world, at least. And, you know, like you said, there are different kinds of human rights organizations or lawyers that can help people deal with different kinds of, you know, government abuses or human rights abuses. But this technological authoritarianism that is rising in developed countries is a whole other ballgame.
And it's spreading. I mean, look, China is sort of perfecting, the Chinese government is perfecting a lot of these different surveillance and social credit techniques and platforms and technologies. And then they're selling them. So for example, Venezuela just bought recently from one of the big Chinese companies, the social credit, it's a certain kind of social credit system. So social credit is the idea that in free countries, we have this idea of a credit score, of course, whereby you know, your ability to buy something is predicated on you know, in financial information. How responsible have you been with your credit cards? You know, do you have too much debt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So social credit takes the idea of a normal credit score and applies your identity, your friend circles, your behavior, what you've said. Have you ever written anything against the government? And it turns it into basically what you could almost call a citizen score. And what they're looking for there is not just financial performance, but also loyalty to the government. So that is being unrolled and kind of evolved across the whole country of China right now. And other regimes are noticing, and they're trying to buy that from the Chinese government. So you're going to start seeing this. There's kind of like this neo-colonialism happening with China that people are starting to talk about. You, of course, have like the Belt and Road, right, which is like this infrastructure expansion whereby China's giving loans to countries all across, like the old Silk Road, all across Central Asia, down through South Asia, into Africa. And they're doing it on their terms, right? This is even happening, of course, in Latin America. And a lot of that is not just cement and bridges and ports, but it's technological infrastructure. So today in Venezuela, from what I understand, the telecom infrastructure is entirely Chinese made. So the indigenous, like, you know, Venezuelan telecom infrastructure is destroyed and broken and doesn't work. So people are using phones because of Chinese infrastructure. So this is happening all across the world, and it's happening really fast. And it's kind of pitting two systems against each other. One is a system where you don't need any sort of approval from the people to do things like spying and surveillance, right? So that's That's kind of the Chinese way. The other way is the way that we kind of have it in places like Japan and Europe and United States, where like there have been violations, of course, but generally speaking, you need a warrant, right? Generally speaking, there's like that you can't just go and press the big red button, right? So this is kind of happening, right? These two different ways of expanding and growing and running technology systems. And it's pretty concerning, I would say. And don't think it couldn't happen in your countries, I guess what I want to say. I mean, there's even countries that are free countries that are becoming closed societies, right? Even close to y'all, Hungary, right? So you're looking at a country like Hungary that had a really rich democratic tradition recently, and through a series of events is, you know, by the Human Rights Foundation, we consider it a competitive authoritarian country right now. So who knows? Don't think it couldn't happen to you. And because of that, we need to really focus on building the technology that can protect people's property and freedom data.
Yeah, it's a difficult subject because on one hand, people want to feel like there's, you know, somebody else is looking out for them, like there's some sort of stability that they can rely on, or, you know, if they pick the right country that they can, you know, be somewhat certain that these things are not going to happen. But that's simply not the case. And a lot of these technologies are evolving faster than the legislation about them does, which is good and bad at the same time. It's good because, you know, these anti-authoritarian technologies can take root and people can start using them, but it's also bad because companies can start using them in authoritarian ways, or at least the technologies that are susceptible to that.
Yeah, and let's make no mistake. I mean, the United States has at least, I would say, probably the equal level of surveillance and censorship technologies at their disposal, meaning the federal and the local governments and the private sector. It's just they're not coordinated to stifle political opposition. That's the difference. So the New York Times just did an amazing investigation into kind of what they could glean about you based on like advertisements, basically, and applications from your phone. And they were able to basically micro track you, you know, from the Starbucks over to your dropping your kid off to, you know, and that's something they could glean like as a third party observer. But the main difference is that isn't being used to like hunt down and track, you know, political opposition and dissidents. So at the end of the day, it remains kind of the decentralized political model. That's the difference. Like, you know, are we being ruled by rules or rulers? And that's kind of the only thing stopping us from lapsing into that sort of kind of social credit dystopia. So to me, old school civil liberties and democracy and human rights activism and advocacy is just as important as building the technology that can help us preserve our freedoms and rights. They have to be done in unison.
What do you think are some of the most important initiatives that are currently focusing on this?
Well, I think there's two. There's the technology side, and to me, that's Bitcoin and a lot of the things being built on Bitcoin are really important. But also, there's citizen-driven initiatives that can be done to check the power of government and large corporations. So, for example, I live in Oakland at the moment, in Oakland, California. So Oakland has a citizen-powered oversight, technology oversight board. It's very cool. So there were some really bad violations and overstepping of the rights of citizens here in Oakland by the police force here. So basically people wanted to put a stop to that. And they were able to create like a board that basically gets to oversee the type of surveillance equipment that the local city's buying. And, you know, like, for example, the city was you know, in the United States, it's legal for the government to have these like license plate scanners, basically. So it's not like China, but basically, you'll be driving through a neighborhood in Oakland, you'll see a surveillance camera up on the traffic light, and it's basically taking a photo of every single person's license plate. And up until recently, they were just keeping all this data, like in a back room somewhere, and they weren't. You know, there was no law saying they needed to get rid of it at one point or another. So they were keeping this like in really intricate, very accurate location tracking data of all the citizens in the area. And a couple like you know, people filed information requests, which of course you can't do in a dictatorship. But they, you know, they were like, give me this data, I want to see it. And once they saw it, they were like, oh my God, this is terrible. So they've been working to create these like oversight boards here so that that sort of thing is harder for local police forces to do. We're talking at like the town level, the city level here. We're not talking federal or even state level, but I think it's got to start in your community, right? So I think that's very interesting and something that really should be thought hard about. I mean, what city in Europe will be the first one to have a citizen-powered technology oversight board? Which city in Asia will be? And I think it's got to start going from there. There must be something like this. And this is friendly to, I think, any kind of person, like politically speaking. Like it's not government regulation. You know, it's a citizen-powered board of people who get to kind of just oversee and kind of spy on the government. I mean, that's the goal here. We want to be spying on our governments as well as them spying on us, right? So that I found very powerful from the kind of activism oversight side of things. On the technology side, the reason I think Bitcoin is so important is because in today's world, when we talk about money, which is like, of course, very low down on the social stack of how we network and communicate with each other, we are losing cash, right? So it's happening in different speeds around the world. But in a lot of countries, you don't pay somebody with a paper bill anymore. At least that's not very common. You don't really use paper or metal money. We think about paper or metal money. These are bearer instruments that can be basically peer-to-peer, private, or even totally private if you think about making a donation at a church box by yourself, you know, or something like that. They can be anonymous, peer-to-peer, and those values are actually quite important. But in a lot of countries, and it could range from Sweden, which of course is almost completely cashless, to China, which is in the urban areas almost completely cashless, to Venezuela, which is almost completely cashless for a different reason, because their cash is useless. But there's different societies around the world which are driving towards being a global cashless society eventually. There are some that will happen later, like the Germans apparently are like very famously pro cash. But the writing's on the wall for in 20, 30 years, you know, there won't be any paper or metal money left on Earth. So, or at least in a meaningful, significant way. So what kind of cashless society do we want to live in, right? So if we can preserve some of the elements of actual cash in the digital realm, that would be really great. So if we could preserve some of that peer-to-peer nature of money, if we could preserve some of the privacy, that would be really cool. And with Bitcoin, of course, was the major breakthrough was the peer-to-peer element of it, the idea that I could send a transaction to anyone around the world and no one would be in the middle, right? So even in a harmless way, like when I Venmo you, how many intermediaries are in there, right? So it's like my bank, your bank, Venmo, maybe somebody else, like 3 to 4 or 5. Each one is an opportunity to censor, to take a profit, to surveil. Meanwhile, with Bitcoin, it's completely peer-to-peer. Now, it's not a privacy technology. It's of course better than like the using the existing financial system where the government can just pick up the phone and call Bank of America or Bank of China or whatever and say, give me all of UV's information. It's a little more difficult for governments to piece together your financial history if you've been using Bitcoin, especially if you're good at using it with operational security. It's going to be much harder for them to do it. But it's not ideal because eventually at the end of the day, with enough resources, they can sort of figure you out. Now, there are other cryptocurrencies that are really important, I think, that where people are experimenting with trying to have more of a private money, like Monero, Zcash being kind of the key most important ones. And there's people trying to make Bitcoin more private. So there's some really exciting things happening on the Bitcoin kind of on the base layer and also on second layer technologies like Lightning Network that will hopefully obfuscate transactions and make it more possible to preserve that kind of money. But in a world where we won't have really cash anymore and where all of our interactions with everyone else, paying friends back, paying your bills, paying your rent, where all this stuff's going to be done through several intermediaries, that's a you know, slippery slope. I mean, you know, that's going down the slope to a world where you don't really have control of yourself anymore. So that's why I think, surprisingly, Bitcoin, you're like, wait, Bitcoin is just some digital cash, it's some digital money thing. When you really think about it, if it could preserve a world where we could keep money, like kind of keep the power of money into the hands of the individual, it's pretty revolutionary, actually. So that's why I think it's so important. And I spend a lot of time thinking and talking and learning about it.
I wanted to just quickly talk about why this kind of privacy of transactions is important, because I think people in a lot of Western countries kind of take it for granted. You know, they're like, well, what are you trying to hide? Are you, you know, buying drugs on the internet? What are you doing with it? But I think what they don't realize is that in most places around the world, like you said, 52% of people live in some sort of an authoritarian regime. And it's not as simple as, you, like, there are more reasons to want privacy of transactions than just buying drugs on the internet.
Yeah, and I'll just, on that 52% number, that's like a political science definition based on the centralization of the political structure. You could have problems with 100% of the governments in today's world. Like, I'm sure some of your listeners do. I'm sure some of your listeners are really not a fan of the way that maybe the United Kingdom does things. London is the most surveilled city in the world, apparently. So, you know, there's plenty of like worrying signs from all kinds of governments, not just the authoritarian ones, I guess is what I want to say. But yeah, I mean, what is a crime, right? So it depends on what society you live in. And, oh, I have nothing to hide quickly becomes, oh my gosh, what if this could get me in trouble, right? And I'll always point to this movie, which I found so powerful. It's called The Lives of Others. I don't know if you've seen it. One best documentary or perhaps foreign film maybe a decade ago. And it's phenomenal. I encourage everyone listening to watch it. But it's the story of basically the Stasi in East Germany. And it's this beautiful real life story of people towards the very end of the regime. And just the way that they kind of spied on everyone. And little things that you did would then result in things like, oh, your kid's not being able to go to a good school, things like that. So, you know, like, what do I have to hide really depends on the society you live in. Because, like, what if you're not doing anything illegally, but what if the person who's overseeing you doesn't like you, you know? Like, it just leaves room for these problems and things that I think most humans would say are bad. The other thing I'll say about that is that when it comes to the what do I have to hide scenario, I think that what's counterintuitive is that as we've seen the evolution of democracy, of decentralized governance compared with tyranny, there's actually less corruption and less kind of like drug dealing and bad guy things that happen in open societies as opposed to tyrannies. And you would think it's counterintuitive, right? Because tyrannies have more laws, more guns, more violence, more force, more control, right? But actually, there's way more illegal activity that happens in dictatorships than in open societies. And I ask people to think about that because, you know, does the same thing sort of hold for decentralized data or decentralized money? Maybe the world is just better if there's more of a distribution of power around our data. Maybe it'll be harder for people to sell and steal our data if power is distributed. Maybe it'll be harder for there to be financial corruption in a world where, you know, money is not controlled by one entity.
Another thing people don't realize is how quickly laws can change depending on who's in power and who's motivated to change them. Like, for example, there was a guy recently who, as a joke, taught his little pug dog to respond to terrible things to it, like gas the Jews, and then the pug would get all like super excited. So it was his girlfriend's dog, and he was trying to like, you know, play a prank on his girlfriend by pretending the dog's a Nazi. And it was actually pretty funny. Like, if, you know, horrible subject, but if you watch it, it's like, it is pretty funny. And most people I've seen see that video have laughed at it, despite their stance on that kind of speech. But he got charged in London with some sort of hate speech thing. And now he's been fined and there's, you know, there's potential greater consequences. There's another thing too. Sargon of Akkad on Patreon. Have you heard about this one?
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a word now, deplatforming.
Right? Yeah, deplatforming. That's exactly right. So Patreon decided, you know, we don't like that thing that you said on someone else's interview, not even in his own content, about
what he said the N-word.
Oh yeah, he said the N-word.
Yeah,
but it was in sort of in jest, or he was referencing something else. Like it wasn't even him using it in the harsh way it's meant to be used. He used it as to kind of parody something else, and then so again he got his livelihood taken away. So I mean, these are all perfect examples. And when the goalpost keeps moving, you know, mm-hmm. we in the West mm-hmm. can look at this and actually start to see where our own rights are potentially taken away as well.
Well, I remember that's why it was six, seven years ago when there was the whole SOPA PIPA resistance to the SOPA and PIPA acts, right? And one of the main things that was important for me was that, like, hey, we shouldn't have this regulation here because then it makes dictatorships, it allows them to justify what they're doing a lot easier. You know, mm-hmm. oh, there's like restriction and content policing in Western societies. Therefore, like, we can do it more, right? So I think the deplatforming and the increasing amount of power in the hands of even these private social media companies is going to continue, right? Yeah. It's going to continue. And that's why it's so important for us to create structures that are where power is more distributed. Another kind of analogous point to that is that these social media platforms aren't just regulating, you know, what's okay to say or not. They're also regulating history. So for example, Vietnam is often called the world's first TV war, right? So Syria is the world's first YouTube war, right? So YouTube has millions of hours of video of the Syrian war. And there's basically individuals and then algorithms inside their offices here in Silicon Valley that are deciding what is real and what's not, and what is history and what's not. And oftentimes they're not relying on Syrian, you know, experts and Syrian activists and things like that to help them through that process. And, you know, I have friends working for groups like Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, which is a citizen journalism outfit that works in Syria and helps get information out. You know, and they've expressed a lot of frustration at this because platforms like YouTube and Facebook will just take down these videos. And it becomes, you know, they become the arbiters of truth and knowledge, right? Yeah. Which is actually very concerning.
And now what do we think is the actual reason for them to deem themselves the arbiter of truth and knowledge and censor these things? Like, because I look at this and I think people, it's kind of coming from the inside, like people pressuring them to take off content that they find offensive. Do you not see it being that, or where does this come from?
I don't think that Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, the founders of these platforms had this as their goal. I don't think this was their ambition. I think it's something that sort of happened. I wouldn't assign like a tremendous amount of initial guilt to them at this point. But it has sort of grown into this monster of like us needing to figure out what's okay and what's not okay to have on these platforms. So again, we live in this the Web 2.0 age, right, where all data is in these centralized silos of Amazon and Netflix and Google and Twitter and Uber and all these different centralized data silos that have all of our stuff. Like when you look at your phone and you look down all the different apps that you have, I mean, you don't own any of that information, right? So someone else does. So this is kind of the age that we live in, is this sort of Web 2.0. And, you know, I think there's quite a bit of interest in a, you know, loosely, you could call it a Web 3.0, which would harken back to the early dreams of Web 1.0, this peer-to-peer way of interacting with people around the world. We'd get to own our own stuff. And that's certainly the direction I'd like to go in. I think there's a reason to break up these big data monopolies and to have people own more of their own stuff. Now, it's going to require more personal responsibility, which is a big thing, especially with when we talk about decentralized finance and Bitcoin. Like, you have to be more responsible with your stuff.
Yeah, you can't just lose your password.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but I think that might be more healthy. It might be healthy in the end for people to actually have more of an understanding of what their property is and who owns it and have them have more personal responsibility. That might be more helpful. But in the end, I would say that's only going to work for like a small percentage of people. If the technologists and activists who want to see a more decentralized future, if these people want to be successful, they're going to have to create consumer content and applications that are easy. Like, you know, for me, if Bitcoin succeeds, no one's going to know they're using it. Like they'll run, you know, their purchases and they'll be sending money to friends and things like that. And they won't have to know how it works. Right. It'll just happen. Right. And that's the big challenge for the people who are building on top of Bitcoin, building stuff like Lightning, who are building things like censorship resistant storage, and who are building even, you know, different kinds of encryption. The average user, you know, the goal is for them to not really understand how it works. It should just be like an easy swipe, right? So that's a challenge. But I do think that in the end, decentralized platforms can be better from an economic and technological perspective. Like if you think about it, if these Web 2.0 giants want to have more transactions per second, right? If they want to accommodate more stuff and features, and they want to do more transactions per second, they have to build more data centers. These cloud data centers are massive. You know, all your stuff, all your photos on Instagram, all of your searches, they don't just go into the ether. They go up into the cloud, which are these massive buildings, right? That require a lot of energy consumption. And you have to grow more of them. And this is more or less a linear growth. You know, you got to build more buildings. But when you have decentralized networks, like, for example, Lightning, which is being born right now on top of Bitcoin, arguably the way it would grow, it could accommodate kind of exponential transactions. So I do think there's a lot of hope for these kind of anti-authoritarian technologies. I think they can be better than the authoritarian ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a physicist that... I can't remember his name right now, but he observed that things kind of tend to centralize and power tends to coalesce around certain nodes, and that is just a physical property of matter, that things kind of just cluster naturally. So do you think that decentralization, the movement of decentralization, is kind of this permanent battle that we'll have to fight against centralization?
Yeah, that's certainly a accurate description of, at least in my mind, how things sort of work. And that's why it's so important to have separation of powers. If you think about society from a governance perspective as nodes, right? You have the military, you have the press, you have the judiciary, you have the printing press that makes money. You know, you have the news industry. So let's say you have 20 different nodes that make up a society. Obviously, in a tyranny, that, you know, one person or one small group controls all of them. The more you can decentralize that, you know, the more that you can distribute that out to have these things be checks and balances against each other, I think ultimately the better. And I think the same thing goes for the internet, right? So when you talk about information and data, the more sort of checks and balances, the more options people have, I think the better. And this goes even to the heart of what makes Bitcoin work, is that, you know, in the end, it has close to, 10,000 approximately active nodes, you know, nodes, full nodes that people run around the world that have the entire ledger, the historic ledger of all the different transactions. And they're the ones who kind of keep the network useful. If there weren't very many nodes, then the network wouldn't be decentralized and collusion and censorship would be very easy. So the only reason why Bitcoin's useful is because it has a lot of full nodes, and that people independently can nearly for free, basically very easily, verify transactions. So this prevents fraud and double spending and things like that. So the decentralized architecture of Bitcoin is actually what makes it work so well. So I do think that it's important for us to have as many nodes as possible in whatever we're building. Yeah.
I think it'll almost be an answer to, I think it has a lot to do with capitalism and zero marginal cost society, that book we read by Jeremy Rifkin. Have you read this book?
No, I haven't.
Well, the essential point in it is that capitalism eventually leads downward because of the constant shrinking margins in order for companies to compete. And I think one thing that cryptocurrencies and decentralized technologies do, since they remove the middleman in many cases, they optimize margins to the point where, you know, peer-to-peer is going to be the cheapest option in many cases in almost any technology you could possibly imagine. So to answer your question from that front, I think it kind of has to be this like hyper decentralization, because centralized entities at some point in any given technology won't be able to actually compete.
But
that is the hope.
Well, yeah, I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate right now, because obviously we're all pro decentralization, but I'm just trying to talk about some of the, you know, questions or opposing arguments that other people might have. And for example, that, you know, some of these decentralized technologies are actually can't compete in terms of efficiency and scalability yet.
Currently.
Yeah.
Of course not. Yeah. And I think we have to think about decentralized governance as a great way of sort of a litmus test for the other kinds of decentralized technologies that we can consider, in that it's not just the decentralization. There are other underlying factors that make decentralized politics possible. So liberal democracy, you know, is possible for a lot of different reasons. Elections are kind of the, and this is interesting, we can talk a little bit about maybe voting on the blockchain and stuff, but elections in a society are kind of like the cherry on top. It's like a mechanism at the very end that ensures accountability, right? But much more important is separation of powers and civil society and free expression, for example. I think those are much, much more important than elections. All dictators get elected. All dictators have elections. The way to have a free and fair election is to have these other things under it. So when we talk about voting as a mechanism, and you read things like Tocqueville, like Democracy in America, and he even talks, you know, a lot about this, about, you know, what is the value of elections as a mechanism, right? They are tremendously important, but kind of as like a final step, right? You need all these other layers beneath them. So when we talk about, I think there's a lot of challenges that, like, let's say, governance tokens are facing today, and they will continue to face, and it's going to be a very big challenge for them, and hopefully they can rise to that. But basically, you know, it's not just, the idea is not just that we want to create abilities for people to have options on a blockchain. That's gonna reflect the society underneath it, right? So governance in the digital world is going to be a very difficult one, and I think for a long, long time won't escape the realities of the real world, right? The meat world. Mm-hmm. So that's just something to think about.
We've talked previously about liquid democracy, and we had Pia Mancini on from Democracy Earth a few episodes ago. This has been an interesting subject for quite a while. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how this would work in practice. What do you think about liquid democracy? Do you think this is a viable potential solution for the future?
Well, I think it's one of these terms that has a lot of different interpretations. I mean, people would say it means a lot of different things. To me, the most useful interpretation that I've seen that I like is to make democracy less binary. You know, vote for this person or not. Why not vote against the person? Why not like have multiple options? You know, why not have, you know, why not be able to vote on more things would be, I guess, the idea of liquid democracy, right? Like make it less binary. Now, I live in the state of California, and I do think there is like a limit to this. So, you know, on election day, I sit down and I read through a ridiculous packet, and we don't just vote for our senator and congressman and the president and the governor and the local supervisors and the school district people who are in charge and the judges. And, you know, we don't just vote for them. We also vote on a series of props, right? So we vote on like, should we dam this reservoir a little more? Should we have a tax on plastic bags? Should we? And it's very direct democracy. Now, that's I think worth debating. Like, are people educated enough to have that? Like, yeah. I consider myself fairly educated, and I sit down to look at this stuff, and you know, it takes me days to feel like I have a solid enough opinion on whether or not there should be a higher minimum wage for the kidney dialysis workers. Like, that's not easy to do, right?
Yeah.
So I do think we should look at limits to direct democracy.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things that I think Pia might have mentioned was the potential to earn money as a voter by voting and by making the right decisions and taking that time to invest in researching what the right decision would be. I think the other interesting thing is when you can pass on your vote to other people. So you can almost like, in a way, you know, if there's someone you trust, you can use some sort of like Patreon funding model to make sure that they're doing the proper research, that they're dedicating the time to make the right decisions. But you agree with this person and their viewpoints, so you pass on your vote to them, and then they can vote on your behalf. I think that's interesting. That's the really like confusing thing for me, though. Like, can that work in practice? I don't really know.
Is that prone to
corruption? I think voting is like a Voting to me is like a final mechanism. So it would only really work well if the society in which this was being done in was relatively free and open. If you took this to a place like Venezuela or Chad or Burma, there would be a lot of crime and corruption in the vote buying. Like there'd be, you know, there'd be a tremendous amount of cartels and collusion. And, you know, it would really have to be something that is built on top of an open society, I think, to work well. But I mean, certainly fascinating. I mean, I don't think there's any government in the world today that pays you for voting, right? Or there are some governments that penalize you if you don't, right? In Australia, you have to vote. And if you don't vote, you might get a financial penalty, right? So I think there's some governments that use sticks. I'm certainly a fan of using carrots. I guess we'll see where that goes. But to me, the challenges of our time are much more about the structure of our networks, and making sure that they are not tyrannies and that they are distributed and that people have a little more say and a little more voice. Not everybody, but some people. I think it's interesting. Like for example, the Bitcoin network doesn't need a million nodes. I mean, it needs like 10,000 or maybe tens of thousands of nodes. In the same way that you can have a democracy function with only a certain percentage of people voting, or only a certain percentage of people kind of checked in and understanding the system. Sure, more is always better, but you don't need 100% of the people online. Let's put it that way. So that's important. Also, this distributed architecture prevents the tyranny of the majority, which is an interesting concept that people have been debating for centuries, right? And it makes it harder for the majority to force their opinions on a small group of people, which is really, really important for defending, for example, religious minorities, in ethnic minorities and things like that in different countries. You have to have a structure that prevents the tyranny of the majority. So in many ways, you know, the voting on the blockchain stuff's got to be nuanced. It can't just be, 80%, you know, we voted, we're going to change it. It has to kind of reflect some of these other incentives and structures that people have figured out how to use in liberal democracies to prevent, you know, ethnic minorities and religious minorities from getting silenced and wiped out. Mm-hmm.
You brought up the education question as well, as far as democracy goes. I mean, how do you deal with that with technology preventing the terrible decisions being made because of a lack of information?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, open societies have better education systems. They tend to produce more leading scholars on average. They tend to have more innovations, more Nobel Prizes, more patent rates. The most brutal and stark example of this is, of course, the Korean Peninsula. When you look at it at night from a satellite, it's completely vibrant and alive with the inventions of Samsung and LG and Hyundai, and a society that's very advanced, so much so that it's forced peacefully its leader out, you know, twice in the last 15 years. And in the north, it's just darkness, and their export is suffering. And it's like the Hunger Games. There's like one little bright point of light, which is the capital, and everybody else is in District 12. And that's of course the extreme, but that is at the ultimate end of tyranny. Is brainwashing only for everybody, right? And at the ultimate end of freedom is like a pretty equitable, accessible amount of education. You look at some of these free countries in Northern Europe, like Finland, Sweden, Norway, that are acclaimed, I guess, for their education systems. And, you know, being a free country is a big part of that, right? So I do think that civil liberties and freedoms are very, very helpful for education. We have big problems with education in big countries like India and the United States that are open societies, and those are big challenges for the future. But I think at the end of the day, when you kind of like line up the top 50 open societies and the top 50 tyrannies, dictatorships, it's a very easy choice. You'd rather be on this side of the fence for education. Mm-hmm. So I think it plays a key role there too.
It seems that the prevention of civil liberties prevents, or the restriction of civil liberties prevents any kind of bottom-up action from happening, and it prevents people from self-actualizing and blossoming and actually doing something about the situation in their country, which is a really fundamental force. And, you know, if we talk about voting, it's by default top down. So I can see why the civil liberties are extremely important.
Yeah, I mean, tyrannies want to remove your ability to make decisions on your own. They want to remove the ability for you to group together and form dynamic organizations beyond their control. Of course, again, the most extreme example of this is in North Korea, where no one ever asks you in your life as a child or a young person, like, what's your favorite color? What do you want to do? That never happens. So the most earth-shattering things for people who escape North Korea and make it to South Korea are these. The struggle of being free is so hard because they don't know. They've never even thought about it before. What do you mean? What's my favorite color? Like, this is literally something they ask. It's so shocking. But yeah, when you look at other dictatorships, I mean, any sort of peaceful, useful, moderate opposition is often the first ones the dictators go after. You saw this in Syria. You saw this in Egypt. This is why, I think there's some sort of saying, like, you know, what grows in the desert, snakes and scorpions. So in a dictatorship, often the opposition is quite nasty in different countries, whether they are religious extremists or like hardcore communists or whatever. So dictators tend to not allow like a reasonable, moderate opposition that could be popular to survive, right? Those people are usually the first ones put in prison. It's in centralized systems, the goal is survival, right? And the goal is to weed out any sort of meaningful opposition. Whereas in decentralized systems, it's about competition. And not always in a brutal kind of capitalist way, but often in a healthy way. I think what's really interesting, I've heard some people start talking about this, you know, if we have this global financial system based on something like Bitcoin, where people can just move around with their money more often, more easily, more freely, it could result in a world where like governments actually compete for citizens as opposed to the other way around. You know, what if all of a sudden, like, this is an incentive structure that forces governments to just be better? Hey, we offer better healthcare and everything over here. Why don't you come over here? We're like competing for your service, right? For you to live here. So global networks could potentially allow for that world. I mean, it's a little bit of a pipe dream, but it's something to work for. Right?
It is kind of happening as far as tax laws goes for cryptocurrency companies. Like, there's new countries all the time that gets, you know, you hear word of some other country that supports it a lot more than another. And then that's suddenly where everyone incorporates.
Well, obviously it happens in a deep way when we think about refugees and we think about brain drain and we think about where do refugees flee from? Only dictatorships. No one's fleeing from Norway or from Germany. They're fleeing from places like Eritrea and Syria or Venezuela. And when you think about brain drain, the smartest people in dictatorships, generally speaking, whether you want to go back to the Nazi Germany or whether you look at like Venezuela today, the president of MIT is Venezuelan. Like a lot of the smartest people in these countries will flee because they can have better chances elsewhere. So you're already seeing a global competition of individuals, and they do want to try and get to free countries where they have a better chance of like life and livelihood and success for their family. But I guess a global networks, borderless networks, will make this perhaps a little more easy. And will incentivize some of these middle countries that are kind of between democracy and dictatorship, hopefully to be a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. This is actually something that we've talked about a few times in the podcast, try to throw this idea around of kind of electivism and countries competing for citizens. And, you know, Singapore being an example of a country that's doing that, at least for business, where they're trying to attract businesses to set up shop there by offering different incentives. But they're not necessarily taking in citizens.
No. And they're also it's a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. It's just what we would call a very
utopian
benevolence. Benevolence, the wrong word, but very subtle dictatorship. Like, they don't, if you disagree with the Singaporean government, if you're a Singaporean citizen, they don't come and kill you or put you in a gulag. What they do is they sue you for libel, and then they own the court system. So when you make a claim about corruption, for example, this happens in Singapore, they will, whether it's in a newspaper that you wrote about or you're at a rally and you say something about the government and how corrupt it is, they will sue you and you will lose the case because they own the court system and you know, you will be forced to pay the government more than what you have, and you become bankrupt. So what happens when you become bankrupt in a free country, for example, or in Europe, United States? you lose the ability to go abroad and run for office. It's pretty basic, right? So this is how they neutralize political opposition. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're a subtle dictatorship. It's indistinguishable from a political science, lens in terms of it's a small group of people who've controlled the country for 60 years, PAP, but they're softer and they're more appealing and they look nicer. And this is, of course, what the Gulf countries are going for too. The United Arab Emirates, Qatar, these societies that are highly authoritarian, but they want to be appealing destinations, right? So this is something we need to be really careful about. And I think something that also people in the technology world need to realize they have a big role in. One of the most moving things I've seen recently was when I was in South Africa. I was at the Apartheid Museum, and there's a huge room that shows how the world came together to say that the apartheid regime was evil, right? So it talked about how the Olympics kicked out the regime and the Commonwealth kicked them out. And eventually, Bono and Sting refused to play there. And there was the Sullivan Principle, so companies wouldn't do business there. And this eventually made a big difference, right? Over time, it was huge. There were sporting boycotts. For some reason, this has fallen out of popularity, let's say, in the world today, to the point where North Korea is like the worst, obviously worse than the apartheid government ever was. And, these people are allowed to, compete in the Olympics. They're allowed to do business everywhere. There are all kinds of people clamoring for us to remove sanctions so that, they can go in and do business with them. So I think that technologists need to think about this carefully. There's going to be a blockchain conference in North Korea in the next couple months.
Wow.
And wow.
It's so crazy to me. And kind of like it's so perfectly 2019. It's like the logical kind of conclusion of this. So they're going to offer you first of all, you're going to have to pay to go on this trip. You're going to have to put hard money in the pockets of this murdering government, this horrible government that runs massive concentration camps and starves and murders and rapes its people. You're going to have to pay like 3,000 euros, apparently. This is what the South Korean government told me. 3,000 euros to go and be on this trip. And when you arrive in Pyongyang, you're going to be taken around. You're going to have to bow down to all these statues of these murdering dictators. And you're going to have to go through all these courses and learn about the quote-unquote history of North Korea. And then eventually, you're going to get to a room and they're going to sit down and they're going to say, teach us how to build a blockchain. And what kind of blockchain are they going to want to build? Obviously, like a highly centralized one that allows them to surveil their people more. So the whole thing is just really ill-intended. And I hope anyone listening doesn't go. I guess that is something that you have the power to do is to, as a technologist, as a builder, as a speaker, is to boycott some of these governments. Like you should be doing the same thing for Saudi Arabia. Like Saudi Arabia holds all kinds of blockchain events. Like don't go, just don't go. Don't build surveillance technology for the Saudi government. And you start seeing a lot of this, not just with blockchain, but if you zoom out a little bit with the idea of smart cities. So smart cities in the end of the day, are surveillance cities, right? So if you're talking about a seamless experience of being able to live in an urban area where you never have to take your wallet out, where you're always just beeping and buzzing through everywhere, that is necessarily going to be like a honeypot and a surveillance state, unless there are like really rigorous privacy laws and freedoms baked in, right? But if you're going to build some blockchain smart city in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, I can rest assured it'll be used to track citizens and basically prevent free thinking and et cetera, et cetera. So be very careful about, if you're in technology, if you're a coder, you're building stuff, be careful about the contracts you're taking and be mindful that, you can make a difference by kind of like boycotting certain countries, certain governments, certain corporations. You have big power. You can have a personal foreign policy, put it that way.
This is a really interesting subject, actually. Can we go down this path a little more to talk about the kind of the hidden side of technological development? Because it seems that a lot of the trends are pointing to Asia being kind of the leader of technological development this century. And the curve of development seems to be kind of, dying down a little bit in the West, and with some of these people's freedoms being taken away as well. Just a lot of kind of projections show that Asia is going to be the leader, which means we're going to be adopting their technology, which is probably going to be heavy on the surveillance and censorship side.
Well, you're right. At the end of the day, it's just a platform. It's just a software. But the software and the infrastructure that they're selling and installing around the world, the default setting, let's say, is, let's just put it this way, it's not privacy protecting. It's built to harvest data and to gain as much information as possible about society for the purposes of stability, right? So this is what they're kind of pitching and selling. So you might be right that, and you are right, I think anyone in the field would understand that China is obviously a leader in a lot of these technologies. They're going to try and sell that technology, and they are selling it, and it's being installed around the world. And cities and urban areas are being built in this way. And that's just something we have to really think hard about, is especially for Europeans, I think, have an opportunity to take a stand here and to build their cities a different way. When it comes to urban architecture and infrastructure, technology is going to become more and more relevant and like pivotal to how you lay out a city and how you build it, because you're going to have to start thinking about how are people paying to get on the train, and how are people paying to use like shareable bikes and shareable cars and everything like that. And right now, I would say there's not a heck of a lot of privacy protecting infrastructure there. Like, you know, when you use like, we have Lime scooters and Ford bikes and all this sort of thing. I mean, you're just giving all your information to these third party companies. Now, I'm not in Oakland, California. I'm not worried about the smart scooter company coming after me. But yeah, if you're in China, you're definitely thinking about the fact that like, oh, the government's like looking at where I'm going all the time. I have this one friend who made a post a few months ago about the Muslim prison camps. Maybe I shouldn't, go see them, right? So like it starts to actually color your decision making. So I think European cities, any city that is in an open country, open society, should from a city level perspective, should start thinking about urban design in a way that protects freedom and liberty and privacy. Very, very important, I think. And key to this whole smart city sort of dialogue and conversation.
And from the perspective of technologists, developing this stuff as well, like, I don't know if people really think about it very much, because, they might get excited about the potential of the technology, but then the applications that are being developed with that technology are also something to consider.
I mean, I can assure you that most don't. I mean, I know a lot of people in Europe, especially, who I'm looking at their Facebook feeds and they're like, oh, so exciting to be here in China for the World Economic Forum here, or the whatever here, and they're talking and they're so excited about being there. Of course, they're not mentioning the prison camps or the fact that if you disagree with the government, you're immediately kidnapped or taken away, or that there's like untold numbers of people in not even in the Muslim or Tibetan areas, but in the general areas of China, untold numbers of people in re-education camps. They're not talking about basically cultural genocide that happened in Tibet. No one talks about Tibet anymore, but the Chinese government basically colonized and won in Tibet. They won so decisively that nobody even talks about it anymore. And they're doing the same thing in the Muslim region of Xinjiang. And they do it in these regions because they're very resource rich and they're huge. They account for a massive percentage of Chinese territory. But it's so strange right now. We're looking at this unfolding disaster in the Muslim region of China, where there's more, according to the UN, there's more than a million Muslims in prison camps. I mean, if they started executing 1,000 of them per day, like, what would the world actually do? It just starts to become really scary. Like, do we actually think that our governments would in Europe and America like do anything about it? Like, maybe. Certainly I wouldn't, the UN wouldn't, given the Chinese government sits on the Security Council. So starts to become a little scary. So it's really important for builders and the people who are designing these systems to think hard about that. It gets so mercenary. Like in China, the generalized way of thinking about how it works is that the government holds these expos in Shanghai, Beijing, for what they call, they don't call it this, but let's call it dark tech. Surveillance technology, censorship technology, ripping stuff off your phone, facial recognition stuff, or gait for entering and exiting areas. And the government basically shops around and picks the best stuff from around the world. And then they hire these companies for pilot projects in Xinjiang, right? And the Muslims are used as the guinea pigs to test out the stuff. And whatever works out really well is then sort of implemented across China and other areas. So this a good example of this is like these like bird drones. So they look like birds, even to a trained eye, from 100 feet away, it looks exactly like a dove or a small bird. It moves in the same way. And up close, it's a surveillance drone. But apparently they've been implemented across like 30 different regions in China. So this stuff is really, really happening. So the flip side is that the builders and the technologists are going to be the new decision makers. I mean, people in technology building tech are going to basically dictate what world we go down, right? Are we going to go down a highly centralized surveillance state world, or are we going to fight to keep some of the world alive with freedoms and liberties and checks and balances and accountability and justice? And it's interesting to think about the fact that the technologist is like kind of the key person here, right? At the end of the day, or at least the people who are in technology companies, they're going to be the decision makers here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
This is a lot of fun for us. This is interesting.
Well, it's been an honor and a lot of fun for me too. Cool. It was great to have you all at the Oslo Freedom Forum, and I can't wait to do more collaboration and introduce you to more fascinating people.
Awesome. Likewise.
Awesome.
All right.
All right. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to our interview with Alex Gladstein. For all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/86. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.